Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. Be future ready with a pension powered by Zurich's award-winning investment performance.
Come, they told me, car-a-pa-pum-pum, a newborn king to see, car-a-pa-pum-pum. Our finest gifts we bring, car-a-pa-pum-pum, ra-pa-pum-pum. Ra-ba-bum-bum. Can you play for me? Ba-ra-ba-bum-bum. On the drum. Ba-ra-ba-bum-bum. Ba-ra-ba-bum-bum. Ba-ra-ba-bum-bum.
Hey! That was great. Leslie Dowd and Mike Hanrahan.
Great.
Thank you.
I played the drums in the Nativity because I couldn't sing to that song. There you go. Paddy Cullivan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm a bit bloated now. That's it from us. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Mary Wilson's on the way. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday evening.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Talk to us about protecting yourself from flu this winter at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. Be future ready with a pension powered by Zurich's award-winning investment performance.
Good afternoon and welcome to Tuesday's Drive Time. Today, high crimes and misdemeanors. Democrats unveil impeachment charges against Donald Trump. Fianna Fáil to back Sinn Féin rent freeze bill. We'll be looking at how a freeze might impact the rental market. The meandering route to a country of polluted rivers. And Aung San Suu Kyi at The Hague. And 2 days out from polling is the British general election finally igniting. The text 5155 won the tweet at Drive Time RTE. Democrats have unveiled two impeachment charges against the US President Donald Trump. The American leader is charged with abuse of power and obstruction of Congress in a process that could ultimately lead to him being removed from office. Democrat Adam Schiff made his case for why they pushed for impeachment.
We stand here today because the president's continuing abuse of his power has left us no choice. To do nothing would make ourselves complicit in the president's abuse of his high office, the public trust, and our national security. The president's misconduct is as simple and as terrible as this. President Trump solicited a foreign nation, Ukraine, to publicly announce investigations into his opponent and a baseless conspiracy theory promoted by Russia to help his reelection campaign. President Trump abused the power of his office by conditioning two official acts to get Ukraine to help his reelection. The release of hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid that nation desperately needed, and a White House meeting with an ally trying to fend off Russian aggression. In so doing, he undermined our national security and jeopardized the integrity of our next election. And he does so still.
Democrat Adam Schiff. Suzanne Lynch is the Irish Times Washington correspondent. We knew this was coming, Suzanne, ever since Nancy Pelosi announced last week that she was instructing the Judiciary Committee to draft these articles of impeachment against Donald Trump. But is it a surprise that they've kept it fairly simple, fairly easy to grasp, fairly easy to understand?
Yes, as you say, this was expected, but is nonetheless a key milestone in the impeachment process that now looks certain to culminate with a vote, a full vote in the House of Representatives next week on whether to impeach Donald Trump. But you're right. In the end, there were only two articles of impeachment that the Democrats chose: abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. And in the preceding days, there'd been a lot of debate internally and behind closed doors about how far to cast the net. For example, should some of the allegations that were contained into the Mueller report, that was the report into Russian interference in the election that took over 22 months to complete, should they be included? But it now seems that no, the Democrats are very much focusing on this Ukraine-specific issue, the allegation that Donald Trump acted improperly when he asked the Ukrainian president to investigate Joe Biden and to investigate allegations of unfounded allegations, really, of Ukrainian interference in the election. So it may be the case that Nancy Pelosi feels that she wants to kind of get this done quickly. It doesn't need to be noted that during the Clinton impeachment, two of the articles of impeachment against him were actually voted down in the House. In the end, only two went forward. So she may want to just keep things more simple this way. But abuse of power and obstruction of Congress are nonetheless very, very serious allegations. And the House Judiciary Committee Chairman, Jerry Nadler, specifically said that Donald Trump had committed high crimes and misdemeanors. That's what's in the US Constitution. And this is why they're moving now to impeach the president.
OK, where do we go from here now? What are the next steps?
So over the next few days, this committee, the Judiciary Committee, and they are responsible for drawing up the articles of impeachment. They are going to debate and revise and perhaps amend these articles of impeachment. But because Democrats are in the majority there, it pretty much seems likely that the articles that were announced today will remain intact when the legislation is drawn up. Then they will vote on that. And again, it looks like they will vote to adopt these articles of impeachment because Democrats have the majority. And that means it will then move to the full House of Representatives. That's one of the two houses of Congress next week. One date being bandied around here is Friday, December the 20th. We could see a vote in the House on that day where the entire 435 members of the House of Representatives would vote for only the third time in history whether to impeach the president. If they do vote to impeach him, which again we expect they will do because of the Democratic majority, it will then move to the Senate for a trial in the early new year. And that's when the tables turn completely because Republicans are in the majority. They have 53 of the 100 seats there. And in fact, you need a two-thirds majority in the Senate to convict a president, to convict him of impeachment and remove him for office. So I think the Trump administration, the White House, are pretty confident that won't happen. And already we see the language coming from the White House that they're looking forward to this, we suspect, Senate hearing next year, saying this morning the White House has said that Donald Trump will be completely exonerated in that. And they are scenting victory, really, in January. And I think that's where you're going to see the White House focusing.
I wonder what sort of impact this is going to have on the presidential campaign, what sort of impact it's having already, because I thought the language Adam Schiff was using there is very interesting. It's in tone and language. It's, you know, we were left with no choice. We didn't want to do this, but it is our duty almost.
I think that is the case because Nancy Pelosi, the top Democrat in the House, she had resisted calls from members of her party to impeach Donald Trump right through this year. As early as March this year, she said in an interview that, you know, impeachment was such a serious and divisive issue that you would only go there really if something really serious happened. But obviously Donald Trump crossed a line, she felt, back in September when the White House revealed details of a phone call between Donald Trump and the Ukrainian president. At that moment, Nancy Pelosi essentially started calling around the different members of her caucus to see if there was widespread support for impeachment. And at that moment, she decided to act. And she has consistently said that she feels this is not something she relishes. And in fact, she's a canny political operator. She remembers Bill Clinton's impeachment when that, in fact, did damage to Republicans, not to Clinton, in the subsequent election. So she's aware of the political risk she's taking. But I think her line is, and Adam Schiff there said that too this morning, that there was a sense that Donald Trump had really crossed the line, as I said, and that it was their duty now as members of Congress to hold the president to account and to essentially uphold the Constitution.
Suzanne Lynch, Irish Times Washington correspondent, thank you. And from one leader to another leader in trouble. The Nobel Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi arrived at the UN's International Court of Justice today in The Hague to defend Myanmar over charges of genocide against its Rohingya Muslim minority. Journalist Stephanie Vanderberg was there and she joins us now. Stephanie, good evening. She was a symbol of human rights. And is she now in The Hague to defend the very people, the generals, the military, that kept her under arrest, under house arrest for so many years?
Well, yes, essentially she is. She's acting as an agent for Myanmar. So today was the day when Gambia presented its case in which it laid out why they thought genocide was occurring in Myanmar. And tomorrow will be Myanmar's reply. And Aung San Suu Kyi is expected to open those proceedings with a statement. And I think they will try to argue that whatever happens maybe might be atrocities, but don't amount to genocide, and kind of rely on procedural issues why the court shouldn't have jurisdiction over this.
She was a peace icon. What has been her reception like and reaction like to her arrival at The Hague?
Well, it was very obvious there were two camps of Myanmarese people. There were several Rohingya protesters against her, and there were also people waiting for her with roses to throw on the car that she was driving. So I think the international reception has been a kind of an idea of deception that this person, who we all thought was a champion of human rights, has never condemned what is going on in Myanmar against the Rohingya, even though countless UN fact-finding commissions and experts have found that really grave atrocities are going on, and one UN fact-finding mission even said that things were happening there, genocidal actions with genocidal intent. So that's quite heavy things to find. Mm-hmm. And she has always denied that those things are taking place and is talking of legitimate actions against terrorists in that region.
As you say, it is Gambia that is bringing this case, and it's being driven by the Attorney General and Justice Minister, who visited a refugee camp, and he has said this is where he believes he saw genocide.
Yes, when he knows a bit about what constitutes genocide, because he used to be a genocide prosecutor for the UN's tribunal on Rwanda. And so he said that when by chance he visited the Cox Bazar refugee camp where all the Rohingya are have fled to, he spoke to some of the survivors of what happened to them, and he said the stories they told him of villages being burned, people being killed and raped and driven out of their towns and kind of forced over the border reminded him so much of the stories that he heard in Rwanda, and felt that that was really genocide, and literally said today in court, when I was there at the camp hearing those stories, the stench of genocide kind of blew over from the border in Myanmar. So he really, really feels very strongly and had a really personal connection with those refugees and a personal mission to get this case heard by an international court.
And even more than those accusations of genocide, accusations that that Aung San Suu Kyi is to blame, not the generals, not the military. She's the head. It is at her door.
Well, not quite in the sense that this UN court that is looking at this is for disputes between two countries. So it's really the government of the Gambia blames the government of Myanmar. So it's not necessarily Aung San Suu Kyi as a personal figurehead, but she has put herself in the place of a personal figurehead for her government by coming to The Hague. So it's very much her that maneuvered herself in this position of being this figurehead. But I think for internal political purposes, it might be very good to present herself as the person fighting these charges and to have this image of her in the accused dock, because it rallies support around her. But essentially, it's not Aung San Suu Kyi as a person who is on trial, or not even as a function who is on trial. It's the state of Myanmar, the country of Myanmar, who is doing this, that is on trial.
And yet, I suppose, In the public mind and in terms of the attention that will be focused on this, the focus is on Aung San Suu Kyi. How long do you expect her to be there?
Well, these hearings are very specific for kind of emergency measures, where the Gambia asks for kind of a restraining order against Myanmar while the court can look in depth at this case. So these are only 3 days of hearings scheduled. And I expect she will only be here for those 3 days and then return to Myanmar, and then we're expecting a decision only on these emergency measures within the coming weeks. But a case before the ICJ generally takes years and years, so we might see a lot more of her when the case really gets going and they start looking at really the case on its merits.
But do you expect in the course of these 3 days, Stephanie, to hear directly from Aung San Suu Kyi? Will she address the court?
Yes, tomorrow is the time when Myanmar can present its case to the court, and she is Myanmar's agent, so the expectation is that she will speak first thing in the court tomorrow to kind of lay out the bones of the Myanmar defense against the Gambia accusations, followed up by lawyers who will make all the legal arguments.
Stephanie Vandenberg from The Hague, thank you very much. It's 17 minutes past 5 o'clock. We're going to hear about a row brewing in Cork City over McCurtain Street and the name of the surrounding area. That's after this.
Enable Ireland supports thousands of children and adults with disabilities all over Ireland. Children like me. Join us and support the Ability and Disability.
Support the Ability and Disability. And this Christmas, support Enable Ireland. Give what you can to enableireland.ie. Thank you and Merry Christmas.
Discover the Hyundai electric and hybrid range for 2020 with a bigger choice of models designed for eco-motoring. Discover the Kona electric, the all-new Kona hybrid, the Tucson mild hybrid, or the all-new Ioniq electric, the latest innovation in our range of eco models. Visit Hyundai.ie to discover our electric and hybrid range, alongside our more eco-friendly Euro 6, petrol and diesel models. Hyundai, the best of all worlds. Discover why.
To secure growth in business, you need a strong team. A team founded on exceptional judgment, expertise and standards. So, if you want to be confident of growth and take your business to new heights, secure your success. Choose a chartered accountant.
We've got great Christmas offers this week at your local SuperValue. Like SuperValue Fresh Irish Lamb Leg, half price. Afternoon tea or Elite Biscuit Range 600 gram to 1 kg, €10 each. USA Biscuit Tin 1 kg, now €8.50. And selected big brand medium selection boxes, 3 for €5. For the best Christmas ever, it's got to be SuperValue.
Drive Time with Mary Wilson on RTÉ Radio 1.
Now, a row is brewing in Cork City over McCurtain Street and the name of the surrounding area. Concerns have been raised over the area being branded in recent years as the Victorian Quarter. And as the city approaches the centenary of the first Lord Mayor's appointment, Republican Tomás McCurtain. Now, it's from this street just north of the River Lee that the RUC departed from when they went to assassinate McCurtain in 1920. I'm joined by Ted Tynan, who's Workers' Party councillor, and John Sheehan, who's the Lord Mayor of Cork. Ted, tell us about Tomás McCurtain and his place in, I suppose, Irish history and Cork history.
Well, Tomás McCurtain was the Lord Mayor of Cork on the night he was murdered by a group of killers who set out from the RIC station on what was then known as King Street and later changed the name to McCurtain Street. And what I getting sort of a little bit fed up with is that one particular councillor, a blue shirt councillor, or should I say a Fine Gael councillor, is referring to the area of McCurtain Street and the surrounding streets and the quayside, Patrick's Quay, as the Victorian Quarter. And I strongly do feel, and look, I know there's far more important issues that come before me on a daily basis, like the housing crisis and health crisis. But in relation to this matter, I think just to be fair and to show a bit of recognition and respect to the Tomás McCurtain, Lord Mayor of Cork, who was murdered on that evening, going back to 1920, that the area around McCurtain Street should not be referred to as the Victorian Quarter. And I would like to suggest at this stage, and I would appeal to the current Lord Mayor, John Sheehan, to rename that district as the McCurtain Quarter.
The McCurtain
and
Quarter.
And I think it's some...
Well, yeah. the Lord Mayor is with us, Ted Tynan. And Lord Mayor, do you consider the area, or would you ever talk about the area as the Victorian Quarter?
I don't, Mary. Good evening. The area was named by the traders locally in rebranding the area in 2013 as the Victorian Quarter, and really has to do with the architecture of the area. Many of your listeners may be familiar with the Everingham Palace and the Metropole Hotel and the Jazz Festival and Isaac Restaurant, and they're all Victorian buildings. And the same way,
and just to say that though, they're all on McCurtain Street.
They certainly are, and just like Dublin has a sort of Georgian architectural heritage, Cork has a Victorian architectural heritage, and that's where the rebranding by the traders and by the people in the area came from. But that has nothing to do really in terms of commemorating Tomás McCurtain, because we will be holding commemorations next year. Next year is a big year for Cork, as you're aware. It's really Cork 1916 with the death of Tomás McCurtain, Terence McSweeney and the burning of Cork. And we're planning on holding a number of commemorations, which will include McCurtain Street in those commemorations, because in a way, you know, history is multi-layered and we can't ignore the past of history. But this is reflective of the architecture and the area, and that has been very successful in the sense
but
that
why
18
not,
new businesses have opened up.
Ted is well able to talk for himself, but why not take up his suggestion and call it the McCurtain Quarter?
Well, we already have the McCurtain Street, which was renamed shortly after the murder of Tomás McCurtain, and we have many other proposals. We have a steering commemoration committee in council. We're planning many events, and some of those events involve renaming streets after some people from that period in time. And we're going to open up that to the public a lot, the same way we did with the Mary Ellen's Bridge, to get public consultation and get people's views feeding into that. But this was done by the locals, by the businesses in the area, and really was just reflective of the architecture, the same way other areas have lots of architectural Edwardian, Georgian heritage and really is to do with that.
But is it in fairly common usage now, Lord Mayor?
It's done by the businesses primarily. It's not really in common usage. I mean, people would refer to the streets rather than the area. So people would refer to McCurtain Street.
But was there a process? Was there a process that the traders had to go through to call the area the Victorian Quarter?
Well, what happened is the certain areas of the city were divided into quarters in terms of branding and in terms of trying to improve their offering. So there was the Shandon area, there was the South Parish area, the Douglas Street area, and this was the traders were consulted and they came up with the with this name themselves. And they've been quite successful in terms of the life of that area has improved.
All right. And just to be clear, Lord Mayor, you don't use the name yourself, but do you support it?
I think it's reflective of the architecture in that period and that part of history. I grew up near that area. All the streets, loads of the streets are Wellington Road, Wesley, Windsor, Waterloo Terrace. It's near a military barrack, so a lot of the names come from that period of time. And I think we can't ignore that.
Okay.
A historian said to me, you know, you don't tear out the pages of history, you turn the pages of history, and our history is multi-layered in Ireland.
Well, Ted Tynan, you've been listening to the Lord Mayor's reasoned explanation of how it all came about. Do you accept it?
I don't think so. The fact is that Queen Victoria was known as the Famine Queen, and that was a million people died in Ireland at that time, and it was genocide as far as I'm concerned. And by the way, Mary, I'm not coming this from a perspective of nationalism. I don't regard myself as a nationalist, but I would most certainly be proud and to stand up for the history of our city. And I think Tomás McCurtain made the ultimate sacrifice to create a decent and fair and free country for its citizens to live in.
But it is Victorian architecture, Ted, the Victorian Quarter reflects associations with Queen Victoria, but rather the architecture developed during her reign.
Yeah. Mary, I understand that and I accept that fully. It is Victorian architecture, just like all the Georgian architecture and a lot of other parts of Cork City, where it has some beautiful buildings going back a couple of hundred years in most cases. But to refer to it as the Victorian Quarter is giving homage to the name Queen Victoria, and I think that is wrong.
So you want, and can you do anything about it, Ted? Can you put down a motion at council? Can you do anything to make change? I mean, have you canvassed the businesses?
No, I have not, because it's Cork City Council's function to name streets and all that in cooperation with people living on those streets. And there was no plebiscite. In fact, it is only one councillor, Fine Gael councillor, who is continuously referring to the area as the Victorian Quarter.
Yes, but as you've heard, it wasn't the councillor who promoted the name, it was the businesses in the area who wanted
it to be
named.
And they have no right to do that. Cork City Council should oversee the naming of our districts, and particularly when a contentious name such as Queen Victoria has been bandied about to identify an area. I don't agree with that, and more so with McCurtain Street.
Okay.
Tomás McCurtain's killers came from the RAC barracks on McCurtain Street, and that building is still there at the moment, is lying idle at the moment.
All right.
So
you wanted it called the McCurtain Quarter.
The McCurtain Quarter.
All right,
Ted
Tynan, Workers' Party councillor, and John Sheehan, Lord Mayor of Cork. Thank you both for joining us. Now, Fianna Fáil this afternoon announced it'll back a proposal to introduce a move to freeze rents right across the country for 3 years. The Sinn Féin bill will be debated in the Dáil this evening. It'll be voted on next week. I've been getting reaction to this idea from arguably Ireland's foremost authority on the rental market, Dr. Lorcan Sir, from the Technological University Dublin.
Well, it's a very interesting move from Sinn Féin at this stage. And what happens is, when you tinker around the edges of a sector for many years without having huge success in it, there have been some successes around rent pressure zones, but without having huge success, you'll find then that people start to come up with ever more radical solutions. And the danger is, of course, that the more radical the proposal, it can have unintended or far-reaching consequences beyond what the proposer thought in the first place. It's a really interesting move. It's not the first time that a rent freeze has been proposed in Ireland, and there will be outcries. I can predict this, that there will be outcries about the constitutionality of doing such a thing, about freezing rents for so long. But the fact of the matter is that the Supreme Court held back in, I think, the 1980s, that the only thing that was unconstitutional about a rent freeze was if it was permanent in nature. And Sinn Féin's proposal, to the best of my knowledge, I think proposes to freeze rents for 3 years. So it should escape the constitutional element, although that doesn't mean that there won't be somebody who might take some sort of legal challenge against, if this came to pass.
What are the likely unintended consequences?
One of the arguments that you're going to see straight away is the landlord sector saying that, you know, landlords are going to flee the market, as they say every time some sort of legislative change or regulation change happens. And you know, the landlord numbers, through a period of intense regulatory change in the rental market over the last 5 or 6 years, the landlord numbers have stayed steady enough above 170,000. There's about 173,000 landlords in the country. But that's not the number to look at. The number to look at is the number of tenancies in the country, because, you know, one landlord can have more than one tenancy. So even if the numbers of landlords are falling, if there are larger landlords, you could find the number of tenancies rising, which is what we've seen. So last year, between 2018 and 2019, actually the number of tenancies in the country rose from 307,000 to 310,000. So landlords fleeing the market, I don't really see happening. And that'll be one of the unintended consequences that you'll hear claims from the landlords about, you know.
We hear that there's a lot of landlords in the Irish market who are what they call accidental landlords. They didn't intend it. They found themselves perhaps through the boom bust with properties they couldn't sell because of negative equity. And they're now saying that they might get out of the market, or it's being said on their behalf that they want to get out of the market, because if a rent freeze comes in on top of other issues, it's not worth their while. Is that true?
It probably is. I think the vast majority of landlords who are leaving the market are people who never wanted to be or never should have been landlords in the first place. And as soon as they see their properties coming out of negative equity, they're exiting the market and they'll sell on either to a home buyer or to another investor. Being a landlord is no longer a hobby, Mary. There's an awful lot of regulation that landlords have to abide by nowadays that they didn't have to 5 or 6 years ago, particularly around standards and notices to tenants and, you know, a notification of tenants of termination of lease and all that kind of thing. I have to say, on the landlord's behalf, I think landlords, you know, at the same, if I was Sinn Féin and bringing in a proposal like this, I would also give something to the landlords, because a lot of landlords, the smaller landlords, which make up the vast majority of our landlord sector, are treated in terms of tax totally differently to the new large-scale build-to-rent investment fund landlords that are coming in, who can set up structures that are much more tax-efficient than your average small-time landlord in Ireland. And I think it would be a good idea to balance the idea of a rent freeze, if it was ever to come to pass, with more equitable treatment of small landlords in our market, so that, you know, you give it one hand and you take away with the other, but you try and, you know, help all parties along.
Can we talk as well about the rent pressure zones? Because they were supposed to stabilise the market. We heard today in some quarters that rents can be running, rent inflation can be running at 7 to 8%. Why is that happening? Why are the rent pressure zones not being policed properly?
Well, between quarter two 2018 and quarter two 2019, rents nationally rose by 7%. And there's a couple of issues. In general, rent pressure zones, which cover more than half the tenancies in the country, which were introduced by Simon Coveney, and mean that rents can only increase annually by 4%, a maximum 4%. In general, they are working to mitigate the worst excesses of rent inflation, without a doubt. However, in about 42% of cases, we are seeing rent increases of more than 4%, which, you know, we're not 100% sure why that is, but it could be new properties coming onto the market. So if a property is brand new, or if it has never been used as a rental property before, they don't have to stick by the 4% rent increase for their first time they're setting the rent. It also, there's a lot of loopholes in the rent pressure zone legislation for landlords to help them avoid the 4% or get around the 4% cap. And then there's just landlords who are just breaching it willy-nilly because they know their tenants will have to pay the more than 4% or have to face moving on somewhere else.
That was Dr. Lorcan Sir, Senior Lecturer at the Technological University Dublin. After
5 o'clock, we'll stay with this subject. I'll be speaking to Fianna Fáil's Dara O'Brien on the Sinn Féin bill that he's now supporting, and Fine Gael's Junior Minister for Housing, Damien English. That's